I am speaking with Western Michigan University history professor Ed Martini. He has written Agent Orange, History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You open this book with the story of a Navy electrician who spent half a day in Saigon. And then you tell us about children at an orphanage not far from there. What do these stories tell us about Agent Orange and how it's been handled since?
Well, they tell us quite a bit about the ways in which what I call in the book the politics of uncertainty have played out over the last several decades. We've got a situation where this veteran, because of the time he spent in Vietnam, even though it was only less than a day, but because of the political activism of Vietnam veterans since the war, he's able to receive significant benefits from the Veterans Administration because he now has type 2 diabetes, a condition that's been recognized as having at least a potential connection to exposure to Agent Orange. Down the road from that airport are these orphanages in Vietnam where children who have grown up near potentially toxic sites suffer, a lot of them with significant birth defects and deformities, but they receive only the support that NGOs and other groups can provide for them because neither the American government nor the chemical companies that produced Agent Orange have ever really accepted responsibility for the potential impact that Agent Orange has. In both cases, we don't know if Agent Orange is responsible for either, but because of the way the politics have played out, veterans from the United States and other countries can get those benefits while people in Vietnam who are still suffering from this can't.
And that's the politics of uncertainty that's in the title, that we can't know for sure who has been harmed by Agent Orange, and the parameters have to be drawn somewhere. And in this case, they are drawn around a United States Navy veteran, but not around these orphans.
Exactly. There's been a ton of research on Agent Orange and dioxin, the primary contaminant in Agent Orange, and about the health effects and health on the impact on the environment. But at the end of the day, part of the lesson of the book is that there are pretty significant limits to what science and what history can tell us about these things that happened a long time ago. So in the absence of scientific certainty, most of these decisions have been based on politics rather than on science.
There was a great debate in the Kennedy administration about whether or not to use Agent Orange. Frame that debate for us. What was the focus?
Well, there were really a couple different issues. The biggest issue is that the Kennedy administration, when Kennedy came into office, he was convinced that the United States had to fight different kinds of wars, unconventional wars, and use different kinds of tactics. And he saw potentially the use of herbicides as a way, as essentially a substitute for troops. He didn't want to send troops to Southeast Asia. And he thought if the United States could use its technological advantages and its resources, maybe that would save us from sending troops in. So herbicides became part of that. They thought if they could flush out the enemy from the jungle, then they wouldn't have to use American troops to do that. And people weren't aware necessarily of the health impact that Agent Orange and dioxin would have and that these other herbicides would have. So the question really became about two different things. It became about whether or not these would be effective from a military standpoint, but then also what the political impact would be. Ostensibly, the United States is going there to protect the South Vietnamese civilians from what they saw as a communist invasion, essentially, a communist revolution. And so they were going for what Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, called the battle for hearts and minds. We needed to win the support of those peasants. But at the same time, then, we're spraying herbicides to destroy their crops and defoliate their forests, which had a significant impact on a lot of these populations. And so the debate in the Kennedy administration really went back and forth between the State Department on the one hand, which advocated not using significant amounts of herbicides, particularly for destroying crops, and the Pentagon and the Department of Defense, which argued for using whatever means necessary in order to defeat this communist insurgency.
And in some ways that fits with the parameters of what those departments do. The State Department is supposed to be about diplomacy. The Defense Department is supposed to be about warfare.
Yeah, and as it did throughout the Vietnam War, the Pentagon usually won out. Even though they couldn't demonstrate necessarily the military effectiveness of these herbicides throughout the war, they won that battle. It was determined that the military benefits would potentially outweigh any political consequences.
I was still a pretty young child when the Vietnam War ended, so I don't have a lot of memories of it, but something I have heard said over the years by people, some even who didn't think we should necessarily be in Vietnam, is that the military was sent there with one hand tied behind their back, that they weren't really allowed to win the war. But does the issue of Agent Orange show how tricky that becomes, that in order, if you're going to use the full arsenal that you have, there will be some side effects, some of them affecting United States troops who fought over there, and some of them affecting the civilians, and therefore causing another set of problems.
Exactly. No, it's a really good point. The United States could have fought the war in a different way. It could have done more bombing. It could have done more things. But those would have had significant consequences, even worse consequences for the people of Vietnam. And that's true in the case of Agent Orange as well. If these herbicides were really to be effective, if they were really going to destroy enough crops so that the insurgents couldn't get access to those, and if they were really going to destroy enough forests so that they could more easily find enemy forces, you would have had just unbelievable environmental consequences, and then down the road, a significant payoff for people's health as well.
What ultimately led to the U.S. decision to stop using Agent Orange?
Throughout the mid-1960s, really starting with the escalation of the war, but especially in 1966 and 1967, American scientists started paying closer attention to the potential effects of dioxin, and they started raising this as a national issue. They petitioned the Johnson administration to stop using this, not because they were absolutely certain what the effects were going to be, but they were beginning to see scientific experiments on dioxin, using dioxin on rats and other animals in laboratories that were showing it to cause birth defects and potentially cause cancer. And so they thought, if that's happening in these animals, there's a good chance that it might be happening for humans as well. So they kept up that activism for quite some time, and it's really only in the early part of the Nixon administration, actually, that they finally get enough political support behind them, and Congress starts paying attention so that the Nixon administration, over the objections of its military commanders, finally ceases the use of Agent Orange and eventually ends Operation Ranch Hand, the operation which sprayed most of these herbicides. So it was really more about domestic political concerns necessarily than it was about what the impact is actually on the Vietnamese people.
And again, politics playing a role and uncertainty mixing in there as well and driving that decision in some way.
Exactly, yeah. They weren't exactly sure, but they thought it was the potential damage was more dangerous than not doing anything at that point. And this is it's also important to remember that this is right at the time when the environmental movement is really gaining steam, that Earth Day is about to happen, the EPA is about to be created. So people are talking about clean air and clean water and the natural environment in a way that they weren't just 10 years earlier when the Vietnam War was really ramping up. And nobody was asking those kind of questions about herbicides or about the environment.
Going back for a moment, you begin Chapter 4 by writing about crucial decisions made in March of 1965 about the conduct of the Vietnam War. You say that some of the most important decisions were not made by the government, but by a Michigan-based company. Who is that, and what decisions did they make?
That is Dow Chemical from Midland, Michigan, which played a significant role in the Vietnam War. They were one of the largest producers of Agent Orange. They also produced huge amounts of napalm, so they were a big part of the American military effort. And Dow had been producing these herbicides for quite some time that eventually became Agent Orange, and they had learned early on that this dioxin contaminant was almost an inevitable part of the production process. And Dow actually learned early on a way to limit the amount of dioxin that would be produced in the chemical reactions for these herbicides. But limiting that meant cooking the herbicides essentially slower, running slower reactions at lower temperatures. So it could be safer that way, but it would have an effect on profit because you'd be able to produce less herbicide over time. And there was a lot of demand for this given the demands of the war. So they basically called all the other chemical manufacturers up to Midland, brought them in, Monsanto and Diamond Hercules, some of these other chemical manufacturers, and tried to get those companies to follow their new safety procedures for limiting this. But by all accounts, they were unsuccessful, and most of the other companies were more concerned with profit and more concerned with producing large amounts of herbicide than they were with limiting the amounts of dioxin in those chemicals.
Would this have somehow made things safer for humans, even if they would have continued to do what they were supposed to do in terms of clearing out, vegetation, that sort of thing?
Potentially. Certainly, the less dioxin that ended up in Agent Orange, the better it would have been for humans and for the environment, for animals, for other people who ended up in the path. Although, as we came to find out more about dioxin later on, we learned that it was even more complicated than we really understood, that it's not just about the levels of dioxin, it's about the timing of it, when people are exposed to it. Young children and unborn children are much more vulnerable to its effects than adults are. Women who are pregnant can absorb dioxin dioxin in different ways. So we learned more about it, but it certainly would have been safer to produce a product with less dioxin at the time. It still could have had, though, significant impact on humans and on the environment, even with low levels.
The last troops left Vietnam now over 35 years ago, the last United States troops. Since that time, what have we learned about Agent Orange, its applications, its health effects, and what still remains a mystery?
We've learned a lot about Agent Orange and about dioxin and its potential effects, although it also seems that every time we learn something new, it raises just as many questions as it answers. So we've learned that exposure to dioxin definitely causes or can cause certain types of cancer and a limited range of birth defects, although it's still a fairly limited number of conditions that the VA recognizes as clearly linked to Agent Orange. It's a much more expansive benefits regime now than it was at the end of the war or even in the 1980s. But there's still quite a bit we don't know about specific effects. And part of what the book is about is really saying that we're never going to actually know a lot of the answers that people are asking questions about. We can never really determine with any kind of certainty that this particular human was exposed to this particular chemical resulting in this particular condition. It's just impossible. There's too many variables. The issue is, again, comes back to the political issue that in certain countries and in certain cases, people have been able to argue for the benefit of the doubt, essentially, that even if this particular veteran can't demonstrate exposure to Agent Orange, he was in Vietnam and he has diabetes, so therefore he should receive benefits. But folks in Vietnam who continue to believe that Agent Orange and dioxin that are still in the soil there are responsible for particular kinds of conditions and birth defects are told by the United States government and by others that, well, we can't show this for certain, and so therefore we're not responsible.
You say in this book that there were certain things that you believed as you started on the project that as you went along and did your research, you found out you couldn't say definitively anymore that that was true. What are some of those things?
I went in with a number of assumptions based on little snippets I'd read here and there. The biggest one, I guess, to me was that there was so much uncertainty within the medical literature itself that when I really started looking at what scientists and toxicologists, what epidemiologists had written about Agent Orange, there was not a lot of certainty about what particular conditions could be linked to that. And the biggest one, I think, is birth defects, that just about any search you do on the internet or if you just do some basic research, you will almost always see Vietnamese children with birth defects accompanying Agent Orange. And it's almost taken as a given now that if a child in Vietnam has a birth defect and they're anywhere near to an area that might have been exposed to Agent Orange, that Agent Orange caused that birth defect. And these are third, fourth generation children now born, decades after the war. And this is the area of the scientific literature that's actually the most divided, that it's really difficult to show any kind of certainty between exposure to dioxin and Agent Orange and these birth defects. So that really surprised me because I had always assumed that as well.
So would you say that most of the things that you discovered cast doubt on things you believed previously, or did you discover some alternative truths along the way that were contradictory to what you had believed before?
I think a little bit of both. I was surprised by some of these scientific issues and the birth defects. One of the other common assumptions that people have as well, the government and the military must have known that Agent Orange was dangerous and used it anyway, even knowing that civilians were being exposed and our own troops were being exposed. And there's still almost no evidence whatsoever to show that high-ranking American officials were aware at the time that this was potentially dangerous. People just weren't asking those kind of questions. So some of those things definitely surprised me and caused me to rethink my own assumptions. But there's other things along the way that said, well, but we still disregarded basic facts about human safety. We still essentially treated South Vietnam like a laboratory for counterinsurgent warfare. And so along the way, I had to rethink a lot of those assumptions. But what I really had to rethink was the extent to which science and historical analysis could provide the kinds of answers that people were looking for, because there's just a limit to what we can know about some of these specific cases.
Does that go back a little bit to what we talked about in terms of the focus of the debate in the Kennedy administration, that it was more or less weighing the politics here of winning hearts and minds versus an all-out military victory and the idea of whether this was harmful to human beings and would cause long-term birth defects and those sort of things probably just never really came up in the discussion.
It never really did. On a couple occasions in these documents, and I've looked through hundreds of these at this point and all from all sorts of sources, that folks in the Kennedy administration did mention human safety issues, but they did so in passing and always acknowledging that the assumption was that it was safe, that people will raise concerns, communists will raise propaganda that this stuff is unhealthy when in fact we know it's safe. This is the same stuff that we're using in our own yards, which in some cases was true. These were commercially available herbicides that a lot of these folks would have been treating their lawns with at the time. That in the early 1960s, before Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring and before the environmental movement really gained a foothold in the United States, people just weren't asking those kind of questions about herbicides and chemicals. Companies like Dow were seen as the future. It was plastics and it was better living through chemistry. So to the extent that they debated these things, it was about politics and propaganda in the Cold War. It wasn't about environmental or human safety.
Were we also at sort of the beginning of the idea of chemical warfare, for lack of a better term, of using chemical concentrations in some way that was supposed to, as you mentioned earlier, limit the need for troops on the ground?
In some cases, absolutely. I mean, most of the language of the treaties and international law in 1960 still came out of a World War I mindset where people were thinking about gas warfare and these kind of things. Nobody had ever thought to prohibit herbicides from chemical warfare treaties because people never thought about weaponizing them in the way that we did in Vietnam, that it was seen as sort of a new and exciting tactic within the Pentagon, a new weapon in the Cold War against the communists. So people had never really thought about herbicides as weapons before. And so when they were debating these things, again, they relied on the language of the Cold War and fighting kind of a new kind of warfare rather than thinking about it in from a biological or a chemical warfare. They were convinced that this didn't violate chemical or biological treaties. And at the time, they were right.
Okay. Anything else we should know before we wrap it up? Agent Orne? Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say the other big part of it is that this is really a global story, that we tend to come back and think about that this is really just about the United States and about Vietnam, and those are the most important actors. But when we really look at the entire global apparatus of chemicals that were produced for this war, that were used in this war, and the veterans from all over the world that fought in this war, we really see that it's a global story, that Canada's involved, New Zealand and Australia are involved, Koreans are involved. And so it really reinforces, I think, the idea of a world that's pervasively shaped by chemicals, so that we can't really escape the reach of these things, and that to really understand the history and the legacies of Agent Orne, we have to think about it in a global scope.
Agent Orne, History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty. Ed Martini, thank you for your time.
Thank you.